Hi, I'm Rosemary. I'm a junior PhD student at the University of Montreal. I work with Professor Yosha Bengio and on deep learning. So today I'll be giving an overview to deep learning. So to talk about deep learning, we have to first talk about machine learning. What is machine learning? Consists of several tasks. So for example, given input X, if we want to predict a value, then this is called supervised learning. If the value is within a set of defined parameters, well-defined set of values, then this is called a classification problem. If the parameter that we want to map X onto is a continuous value, then this is called regression. And both of these belong to supervised training. We also have unsupervised training. For example, if we have a data X, we want to cluster similar types of data together. This is called clustering. Given an X, if we want to estimate how likely is this data from the true data distribution, then this is called density estimation. For example, if an X has a vector of dimensionality of 100, and if we want to map it to a vector of dimension 10, this is called dimensionality reduction. And this all belongs to the group of unsupervised training. There's another group of tasks in machine learning called reinforcement learning. This deals with a slightly different problem. This deals with the problem of, let's say you perform a set of actions. You don't get an immediate reward. So let's say you're a robot. You want to go to, you know, the other side of the wall, but you can't see the picture of the entire room. You'll only find out once you bump into the wall. So this is a problem of basically doing credit assignments, since you don't get your reinforcement signal right away. So what are the key ingredients in machine learning? To be able to build a really good machine learning model, we need a couple of factors. So first, we need a lot of data. And by a lot of data, I really mean data that presents, that has a good presentation of the true data distribution. And once we have a lot of data, we need a model that's very flexible to be able to represent those data, to be able to present this data distribution. And if we have a lot of data and a flexible model, we need to be able to train it. And for that, we need a lot of computing power. And other than those three facts, we also have to fight something called the curse of dimensionality. And what do I mean by that? So let's say I have a data point that has a number of features. For each of those features, I can take on a couple of different values. Then I have an exponential number of combination of those features. Then for the machine learning algorithm to be able to learn a good distribution of this data, then I would need to see at least a few data points for each of those combinations. That means if your data has n dimensions, then you will need exponential amount of, so let's say 2 to the power of n number of data to be able to build a good machine learning model. The last one is to be able to disentangle the latent factors of your data. What I mean by that is there are latent factors that you have to that correlates to each other. So we have to be able to disentangle that to be able to. So essentially, we have to understand the data. So that being said, a lot of this problem actually maps onto representation learning. So what I mean by that is saying, if I have a set of data X, I want to be able to find good features for X. Because once I've found out a good feature representation for X, then performing a lot of the machine learning tasks, such as classification, regression, clustering, density estimation, these problems all become very easy if I have a good feature representation of X. So this actually comes down to be able to generalize well. So we want to find a good feature representation of X that also generalizes well to unseen data. And below we have a graph that shows what is the problem with the classical machine learning approach. With the classical machine learning approach, if you have a one-dimensional data and it can take on 10 values, then all you need is 10 data points. If you have 2D data and each of them can take on 10 values, then you will need 100 data. And if you have a 3D value, then you will need 10 to the power of 3 data. So this, the amount of data that you need grows very quickly, and this is not good. So how do we bypass this curse? So essentially what neural network models or deep learning models are aiming to do is to basically learn latent features, and then we learn how these latent features are structured together. So we basically learn how these are composed together to form a data distribution. So if you think about how humans talk, we don't learn all possible combinations of words to form a sentence. We learn words, and we learn some semantic meaning of the words. We implicitly learn some grammars, and then we try to compose everything together. So this is an example of the classical machine learning approach. So for example, for things that has been used, the traditional learning approach, the clustering, nearest neighbor decision trees, what they do is every time a new parameter is added, it essentially cuts one of the existing regions of your feature space into half. So essentially, if you have n features, you can only represent kn number of subspaces. What deep learning, what neural networks are supposed to do is something very different. So each hidden neuron in your neural network cuts your entire feature space into half. So not just the region of it, but your entire feature space into half. So what this means is that if you have n number of neurons, you can have exponential amount of sub-regions in your neural network. So some of the things that we can learn with neural networks, for example, this is a neural network language model. So this is essentially a word embedding. For any word, I want to learn a vector that represents the word. And then what it essentially learned is, for example, king minus queen is approximately the same as man minus woman. And if you do Paris minus France plus Italy, you get Rome. So this is great because we didn't ask the network to learn the semantic meanings, but it learned it by itself. So here we have a picture that shows the problem with generalization as well. We want our model to be able to generalize to unseen data as well. So we have to be able to guess which is the region that we have to be able to guess the region where the probability mass concentrates. So here's a picture here, and the different colors corresponds to the different probability mass. Okay, so now I've talked enough about representation learning and why it's so great. Then I guess we should talk about why we want to use deep learning after all. So deep learning, for example, the traditional machine learning methods, as I've mentioned earlier, when they are trying to learn features, they're not trying to learn features. They use a set of handcrafted features. So let's say once you get a new data set, you design a set of handcrafted features for this data set. This is by humans, so this is time consuming and needs expert knowledge, and this is incomplete. So what we really want to do is to have an end-to-end trainable way of doing that. And neural network does it. So for example, if a neural network sees a person, what it learns is this person wears, for example, does this person wear glasses? Is this person a female? Neural network automatically learns features that it needs to be able to produce a good model. Oh, sorry. I just realized maybe I wasn't really speaking to the microphone. Another way that neural networks helps is by learning something called a distributed representation. And this can fight against the dimension of the curse of dimensionality. And what I mean by that is, so for example, in the traditional methods, what you do is you have a menu set of features, and then usually you have a linear model to be able to combine those features together. And neural networks learns the features that it needs, and not only that, it actually learns nonlinear ways of being able to compose those features. And the third and probably one of the most important thing in deep learning is the word that corresponds to deep. So deep means we need multiple layers of representation. And why we want to do, the reason we want to do that, there are several folds. So first, this is biologically inspired in the sense that your brain doesn't just have one layer of representation, it has many layers of representation. Other things are like, if you've learned a good intermediate layer representation, you can use this for other tasks. And the last one, mathematically speaking, there are family of functions that you really need a deep network to be able to present. If you use a shallow network to present the same family of functions, then you will need an exponential number of neurons. So here's an example of what the deep neural network is able to learn. So this is a task of doing face recognition. So as you can see in the first layer, the network learns basically edges. In the second layer, it learns to compose those edges into things like eyes, nose, and mouth. And your third layer basically learns to combine those parts of those regions of your face and is able to combine that into a face. So it learns higher and higher level representations as the network gets deeper. So here's a summary of basically the different machine learning methods. So on the very far left, you have the rule-based system, which is just, you don't learn anything, you don't learn mapping, you have, it's a preset of defined of rules. And the second one where you have classical machine learning, the features are handcrafted, so they're predefined, and you learn a mapping from those features to your outputs. For representation learning, you actually learn your features and your mapping from your features to your output. For deep learning, though, you don't just learn one single layer of features, but you learn your simple features on the bottom, and then you learn your higher level features on the top, and then you also learn a way of mapping those features to your output. So this is all great, and maybe you're wondering, hopefully I've convinced you that deep learning is it's a good thing to do. Maybe you're wondering why is it only so hot in the last couple of years? Why hasn't people looked into this before? There are several reasons for this. So for example, if we want to do deep learning, because the model is very flexible, we need a lot of data, and we didn't used to have this. The second reason is computational power. We didn't used to be able to run thousands of threads like how we do on a GPU at the same time. We can't do that. So now we can run our algorithms on GPU. The GPU can run thousands of threads in parallel, and it's very fast. And the third reason is before 2006, it used to be very difficult to train a deep neural network. In 2006, Jeff Hinton came up with a way to basically get a good initialization of your deep neural networks by doing something called unsupervised layer-wise pre-training. And all of this has enabled us to do basically deep learning today. Sorry, this is a bit not very high quality, but this is all great. So I guess I've told you a bit about why deep learning is great and why we need representation learning and such. So I guess now we have to get into a little bit of technical detail. So neural networks is really not that difficult. If you understand logistic regression, you probably understand the basics of neural networks. So neural networks essentially is composed of many layers of nonlinearity. And one of the very popular nonlinear functions, the activation functions that it uses, is the logistic function. So what it does is very, very simple. So you do a linear transformation, well, alpha transformation on your data x. So it's your x times your weight w plus your bias. And then you squeeze everything within a bounded function between 0 and 1. So you have your y. And what deep neural network does is basically it stacks a lot of these layers together. So it has multiple compositions of the same function. And it's great because here you only need an input and you need an output. And you don't need to define what the middle layers are supposed to learn. It should be able to learn that by itself. So I've shown you the architecture of a basic deep neural network. And so how do we actually train this? This is, so by training, I just mean perturbing the weights so that my errors are small. For a single layer neural network, it's very simple. You just get the error derivative with respect to your single layer of weights, and that's it. For multiple layer, it's slightly more complex because of the composition of the hidden layers, your functions are actually non-convex. So basically, essentially what you do something called backpropagation. So essentially what you do is you have your error, you differentiate your error with respect to your last layer of hidden layers, and you're saying, how much does my last hidden layer contribute to the error? And then you look at the layer before, and you say, how much does the layer before that contribute to the error in the next layer? And so on and so forth. So here's a very simple example of a feed-forward neural network. So basically, you have your input x, you perform your linear module, and then you perform your nonlinear module, which is rectified linear units. So rectified linear units are very, very simple. If your input is below zero, then it outputs zero. Otherwise, it outputs the actual value. And on the top, when you have your model output, you compare that to your desired output, and then you get your objective function, which may or may not correspond to your true cost. So that being said, we're just going to quickly. Feed-forward neural networks is great, except that they have two problems. So first, they couldn't deal with sequences of variable length, and second, it's not able to do long-term. It's not able to look into the context. So then people invented the recurrent neural network. So what this does is basically it has a feedback connection from the state back to its current state. So it's just saying that we have some shared weights across the different time axes. So at any time t, your state st is basically a function of the value of the state in the previous time step plus its current input. And you can, on the left-hand side, you have the graph, and you can basically unfold this graph through time. If you unfold this graph through time, then essentially what this is saying is that the value of your state at time t is just a function of all your input up until your current time step. And here's probably a clearer picture of how everything unfolds. The U, V, W, all these weight matrices are shared across time. So what are RNNs used for? RNNs are used for many things. A lot of the times they're used for as a generative model. And basically what I mean is, during training, I pass in the ground truth output back into my input. And during testing, I pass in the model output back into my input. And that brings us to the next slide, called teacher forcing. So this means that, so you can see on the left-hand side, so the left-hand side is what your model output is, but it doesn't actually pass in your model output. It passes in during training. During training, it actually passes in your ground truth output. And that brings us to a problem, because during testing, we don't have the ground truth output. We have to use the model output. This means that during training and during testing, basically the model is not seeing the same thing. The model is only able to do one step correction. So that means if the model, let's think about a driving car. If the car is driving, if it drove off a little bit off the road, it's able to correct itself. But if it's very much off the road, if it has fallen into a ditch, it wouldn't know how to come back because it has never seen that during training. And this is a major problem with recurrent neural networks. There are several ways of dealing with this, and yeah, which I'm not going to go into details here. There are also other things that of concern to recurrent neural networks, for example, the depth. So most of the time, you want to be able to increase the depth of your recurrent neural network. On the upper left-hand side corner, you have the just a simple RNN, ordinary RNN, and then you can add depth. You can add depth either through the head-to-head layers or the head-to-output, the head-to-input layers. As you can see on the left-hand side, down the bottom. There might be other things that you want to do. For example, you might want to add shorter passes as well as longer passes. So in that case, you can actually add a skip connection, if you can see on the right-hand side. And so why do we want to add skip connections? That brings us to the problem of having long-term dependencies. So essentially, RNN gradient is computed in the following way. It's just basically a product of your Jacobians across the different time steps. And this actually has a value, has a problem, because if the eigenvector of your Jacobian is greater than 1, this leads to exploding gradient over time. So what this means is that something, input that you have seen from a long time step ago is going to count more and more as the time goes on. Otherwise, if the eigenvalue of the Jacobian is smaller than 1, then you have a vanishing gradient problem. This means that things that you have seen from a long time step, a long time ago, is going to count less and less as you move through time. And this is a very strong prior to have, and it's not always right. There are a few ways of dealing with this. So for example, for the exploding gradient problem, you can deal with it by doing something very simple called gradient clipping. This is just saying that, okay, I have a scalar, I set a scalar number. If the norm of the gradient is greater than this number, I just cut it. So this is saying I trust where the gradient, the direction of the gradient, but I don't trust the value of the gradient because it's too big. There are no easy ways of dealing with vanishing gradient, but there are some architectures that's able to deal with it. There are things that's called gated recurrent neural networks and long short-term memories. So basically, GRU is just a lighter version of LSTM. What this essentially actually does is just adds a skip connection through the hidden layers across time. So that means your error is able to be backpropagated, let's say, into 3 time steps or 4 time steps, many time steps before. So this will help with long-term time dependency. So I think that was an overview of basically RNNs and feed-forward neural networks. Now we're going to talk about some of the applications, the current applications, how people are using it these days. What's really popular these days is something called an encoder-decoder structure. You can think of this, so for example, if I want to do machine translation, if I want to translate English sentences into French sentences, what it does is it has an encoder network that basically raising the entire sentence, summarizes that sentence into a sentence summarization, pass that on to my decoder, and then my decoder is able to see the summary of the sentence and decode that back into French. This is really good, and this has worked really well for things like machine translation, but it has a problem that if the sentence gets very long, then the encoder-decoder network does not work as well. So then people actually invented this model called the attention model. So what the attention model does is that you have either your input or your lower level presentation of your data, and then your higher level presentation is basically able to learn where to look. And the way it does that, it basically assigns a small MLP, like just a small feed-forward neural networks, to your lower level representation. And the weights that corresponds to the weights actually just corresponds to probabilities of each input position. So if you can think of this as for example things like image captioning, when you are saying a specific word, it's able to find the position in the image which the word corresponds to. And the attention model is very popular right now. It has shown great improvements across many different tasks, including speech recognition, machine translation, image captioning, and several other tasks. So that's all great, but how does a neural network really remember things? Because the RNNs actually store things in its weights, and it's actually not able to remember things for a very long period of time. And this corresponds, this is very similar how your brain does it as well, because your cortex can only remember things for up to about 20 seconds ago. we really need something that acts more like a hippocampus in your brain, so a separate memory region that's able to remember a longer term memories. And this has been, people have been trying to conquer this with a few different types of models, like long short term memory, memory networks, and neural Turing machine. So here I'm just going to give a brief overview about memory networks. So what memory network does is that it doesn't store memories in its weights. It actually has an augmented memory. So this is a task of basically to deal with question answering given a story. So basically what you do is for each sentence in the story, you treat it as a memory. You embed that memory into your lower matrix, the blue one on the left-hand side, and then you also embed your question. Then you perform attention on your question over those memories, and you say, okay, if I'm asking where's the apple, I want to see which sentence actually will give me the answer. And then you'll have this weighted sum of your sentences. Basically, each weight corresponds to how important the sentence is to that answer. Once you have the sentences, summarization of the sentences that are important to your answer, then you can easily decode it with respect to your question. For example, if your question is, where's the apple, if the memory you found that corresponds to it was John took the apple from the bedroom and then he walked to, I don't know, the bathroom, he washed the apple and put it down, then if you ask where's the apple, you should get the answer, the bathroom, basically. So I guess that was a quick overview of deep learning and the current models and the current research. There are a few problems. There are still like many problems in deep learning. There are a few problems that's I think it's very important right now. For example, credit assignment in recurrent neural nets. There's still no really good way of being able to do that. Also, things like online learning for RNN, because if you want to do learning for RNN, you have to backpropagate your errors throughout all the time steps. And if you have a sequence of links, let's say 2,000, you have to backpropagate it till 2,000 time steps, and this is not so good. So we want to be able to do online learning for RNN. There are also other things such as unsupervised training, because labeled data are still scarce. There are not many labeled data, and also other things like generative models. So I think that was a quick overview and its current problems. Thanks for listening. Yeah, feel free to ask any questions.
Thank you, Rosemary. Questions?
Yeah, so on one of your earlier slides when you're talking about the deep neural networks, you had the different pictures of what the different layers identified, like the edges becoming parts of faces, becoming being composed into faces.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how that was generated, how that was diagnosed from the network as, How were those figures generated from the network? Like, how was that information pulled out to identify what?
So this is usually learned by something called a convolutional network. So it has like feature maps. Essentially, I was saying the network learned it itself. So there was no constraints in what the network is supposed to learn, other than if you use convolutional net, there's things like it makes some assumptions about your spatial structure, in the sense that, okay, if I see an eye, I should be able to see an eye somewhere in the graph. But other than that, no, the network totally just learned that by itself.
In your last point, you wrote generative machine or generative learning.
Yeah.
And I just was hoping you might add some more comments regarding that.
So generative models, people are not able to build very good generative models right now. So generative models can be very useful for things like speech synthesis, handwriting generation, and it's generally, it's But it's generally a harder model to learn, because if you want to learn a discriminated model, all you have to learn is to be able to discriminate between, let's say, two different classes. But to learn a generated model is generally just a harder problem, because you have to learn basically the full data manifold, and that's difficult. But there are many applications of it. Let's say, you can pretty much use it for there are lots of anything that has to do with synthesis, speech synthesis, handwriting synthesis. There are many applications of it.
Some people argue that quantum computing could help with that, and I'm wondering if that's part of the conversation in your community.
Well, I guess that's what I'm here to find out. Yes. Right here, Badano, Cho, Bangio. I have a reference. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, maybe it's a good time to take a break before our tutorial. Let's thank Rosemary for bringing me.
All right. Thank you.